I'm Divya Shekhar, and this is From the Bookshelves of Forbes India. We have two very distinguished guests on today's episode. Raghuram Rajan and Rohit Lamba believe that India's best days are still ahead. India's democracy, they say, is one of our biggest strengths, and we shouldn't lose it by any stretch of imagination. Their new book, Breaking the Mold, Reimagining India's Economic Future, talks about the various aspects of change that the country needs to implement for economic growth. Rajan, a former Reserve Bank of India governor, and Lamba, an economist at Pennsylvania State University, talk about why ideas, creativity, and human capital should be at the center of India's vision for growth and development. How, instead of aping what China did many decades ago, India can embrace its strength, including its diversity, culture, and demographic dividend while moving forward. They also weigh in on why India needs to reprioritize how its resources are utilized in order to keep the focus on basics like education and healthcare, whether we are on our way to becoming a product nation, and how we can tackle social and economic inequalities. So Rohit, I want to start with you. There's a line in the book where you say that if India wants to realize the economic growth that it has envisioned, we have choices to make on where we want to devote our resources. And I quote, in people or on things. Why can't it be both?
Obviously, it is both. It can be both. I think what we're trying to say is that there is a certain level of focus that has gone into things which is legitimate given the kind of poor infrastructure we have come from and we were used to. But it's becoming increasingly clear that in the economic kind of path of the future that India is going to be on, our binding constraint is not going to be infrastructure. It's going to be our human capital. Mm-hmm. At least to us, this is clear. So it's not, I mean, obviously it's amazing, you know, right from earlier times, but also, you know, much more so from the Vajpayee government's time, you know, building the Golden Quadrilateral, now building rural roads, ports, airports, all that is, of course, very, very important. And we're doing that, and logistics are becoming easier. And obviously, Mr. Gadkari did a fantastic job in it. But I think in the process, we really have lagged behind because at the end of the day, both in terms of our government capacity and resources that we generally have, we're still a relatively poor country. You will need to prioritize at some point. And one of the examples we give in the introduction, which we to us spoke very deeply, was that was the example of the Micron semiconductor plant. Obviously, it's great that we should be producing semiconductors. Nobody's against that. But how are you utilizing your resources, right? So if you remember the figures, stunned us a little bit, was that, you know, the subsidy required by the central and the state government in total amounts to 16,500 crores. Yeah. And the entire higher education budget of India from the central government is 44,000 crores. So about a third of your entire money that you send to the IITs, the IIMs, the IISc, TIFR, all central universities, you are going to spend on one plant, which is probably going to generate a few thousand jobs. So that's what we mean, that you are prioritizing resources, right? You're clearly prioritizing resources. Or, you know, if you think of that, how much money we put on fertilizer subsidies. Not that fertilizer subsidies are not important. You know, in the last year was 2.25 lakh crores, right? So again, that is more than the entire higher education budget of India. It's also more than the entire primary education budget of India. So in some sense, this is what we mean, that the time has come, if not, it will already come in the near future, where we will need to really prioritize our resources.
I want to go back to the Micron data that you just mentioned. In the book, you write about how if the facility creates 5,000 jobs with a subsidy of 16,500 crore rupees, the government would have paid close to 3.2 crore rupees per job. Now, if we assume that the Micron subsidy is justified, from where else can we get the money to increase allocation towards, say, education, healthcare, and development of human capital? Are there other avenues of investment that we can explore?
What we try to emphasize in the book is a lot, both on the extensive margin in the sense that a lot more resources need to be put in, but also a better utilization of resources. Yeah. So it's not as if that we're not spending, and we do that especially in the chapter on healthcare.
Yeah.
We are spending now increasingly reasonable amount of money on healthcare, but what is it being used for? Is it being used judiciously and so on?
Hmm.
So I would say that both first, that that I don't think this is set in stone. We are trying to encourage a different way in which we would not spend the 16,500 crores on Micron, but on higher education. In the near future, much more money needs to be spent on health and education, and right. we need to make much better use of the money we're already spending.
Right. How do we go from being a pure American style capitalist growth path and sort of balancing it with building this social capital, human capital, and social infrastructure that we need? Say, in this day and age, what's the formula for realizing the mixed economy vision that India was set to follow post liberalization?
Yeah, look, what we're proposing is a change on a number of dimensions. It's not just change. Here is a set of policies that you should follow. We actually think a lot of change will come from re-examining our governance system. We moved towards decentralization in the early 1990s with Panchayati Raj, but we never fully carried it out.
Mm.
We devolved some functions, more so in some states than others, but we didn't devolve funds. Local governments don't have the necessary funds often, and they don't have necessarily people. That's something we document in the book, how much more sort of people there are at the local government level in other countries relative to India. And so when we talk about investing in people, it all implies that it's done better when you decentralize, because people can hold local government officials responsible if the school is not working. If the dispensary is not open, they can hold somebody responsible. Today, it's much harder to do that.
Mm.
And if you look at where it has been successful, where public services has been successful, an example that comes to everybody's mind is Delhi. And why is Delhi successful? Because Delhi is not much bigger than a district in terms of size. And so when everybody can see what is happening to the local schools, then the local authorities get some benefit because they've made a positive change and they get rewarded for that, because the AAP government has benefited tremendously from making those changes to, the Mohalla clinics, to the schools. And I think that this is, in a sense, the broader point we are trying to make, that if you want to do this, it's a whole of country effort. It's not just here are 10 policies, go follow it.
Mm.
It is we need a fundamental change both on the governmental side, but also on the economic policy side. And then we will get the, I'm not so much mixed economy. We don't spend a lot of time in the book on whether it should be private ownership or public ownership. We think that's a tired game. Go with the ownership which works best and see what works best under different circumstances. A lot of the time it's about incentives and getting the incentives right. But what we're saying really is we do need more democratic governance, and that means bottom up. It's not just elections. It is the ability to hold your local authorities responsible for what they're supposed to be providing. That will make a huge difference.
Right.
And that will give us a I don't know whether you want to call it capitalist or socialist, but it'll give us an economy which is much more sort of equitable in terms of providing everybody the opportunities they need. Today, it's very skewed, and that is a problem.
Right. In the book, you also mentioned how when we talk about decentralization, about how why it's important to also empower officials at the local level, at the panchayat level. You use the example of China to illustrate how authorities at the local level, say in our case, maybe at the panchayat level or the district level, are empowered much more to take decisions. So is that something that also that we need to work on now?
I think the relevant principle is the principle of subsidiarity, which means don't take decisions at a higher level than they have to be taken.
Mm-hmm.
Push every decision that you can to the lowest level at which it's efficient to take it. right? So there are so many decisions which can be pushed down further. You don't need to take decisions, for example, on primary schools at the state level, at the state capital level. I mean, a state like Uttar Pradesh has 240 million people. That's about two-thirds the size of the United States. And Uttar Pradesh is governed from, you know, Lucknow. It's governed from the capital. And, you know, it's hard to imagine a country of that size being so centralized. We need to decentralize not just to the district level, but down to the panchayat level, many functions. You know, for example, primary schools. Shouldn't the primary schools at the very least be governed at the district level, even below that? Why should it be at the state capital level? You know, dispensaries. Why can't each district have a hospital which is governed by the district authorities so that, you know, district people know who to whom hold responsible if the hospital is not working? In a sense, what we've done is we've kept the governance structures we had during, you know, post-independence, when the primary problem in the country was national integration. We needed to create a country, you know, merge the princely states with the other states to make a country. That problem is behind us. We have a country. It is an integrated whole. Now the issue is, how can we make it governed better? And for better governance, one aspect is decentralization. Of course, there are other aspects we talk about, including strengthening democracy more generally.
So you talk about our rich demographic dividend early on in the book, and India seems to be at a point where China was, say, three decades ago, and India might be more well-positioned due to its demographic dividend. You speak about the soft power. India's soft power is at its peak. So could we, but you also say that we have to build on our hard powers too, say, forge geopolitical alliances, among other things. So could our position right now, our India's soft power, for example, help us in forging these alliances or help us in geopolitics and in economic growth as well? And how can we go about doing that?
Sorry, this is a little anecdote we have in the book, you know, where we were kind of warring with Canada. I was in the University of Toronto giving a talk, actually. It was a bit hilarious because tragic. Yeah, sorry. I mean, you know, I have to be careful with words. So, you know, you know, the number of Indian students going to Canada is at an all-time high. You know, the number of requests for PRs, permanent residencies from India, is at an all-time high. You know, and we're kind of, you know, in a situation where we are being asked about, you know, whether we've carried out an operation in a different country. You know, and so we have to be careful going forward how we, you know, what kind of soft power do we want to kind of show in the world, and what kind of hard power do we want to use and when to use? And, you know, India's greatest example was why we were considered, you know, a part of many international organizations and so on, and welcomed, was it because despite being poor and despite having a lot of constraints, we were a beacon of hope for the developing world because we were a consistent democracy. And we took that very seriously all through our modern history. So, and this has been going for us, right? So what we describe in the book is more sort of, we should continue on that path while pushing more on more economic aspects, for example, in being part of regional treaties. One thing that we are very particular about is that since we believe that globalization and services is going to be very important going forward, India should take a leading role in penning down the kind of treaties that we need to sign so that our doctors, our engineers, our lawyers, our accountants can directly supply labor without actually physically moving to Western countries. There are no rules as of now for the terms of trade of services as they are for goods through Organization of the World Trade Organizations. So there's a host of things in which India can really kind of build and then expend its capital when it comes to both soft and hard power, and we need to get our priorities right.
If you think about soft power as being our culture, our example, right? As Rohit said, post-independence, we had a tremendous example for the rest of the developing world of gaining independence in a non-violent way, right, of having leaders of the stature of Mahatma Gandhi, Jawaharlal Nehru, Pandit and Sardar Patel. I mean, these were people that the rest of the world looked up to. And I think with their example and the fact that India is the home of at least three great religions and more various kinds of philosophies and so on, that gave us a kind of allure in the rest of the world. People came to India to learn. However, I think going forward, a lot of our soft power will come not just from this historical past, but also the kind of ideas that we create. You talked about perhaps a different form of capitalism. Maybe that will emerge in India, a more equal, egalitarian capitalism, especially if we focus on building human capital. But we are a country which, as we talk about in the books, became democratic very early in our development path. We still haven't become a middle income country. We are slowly getting there. But if we do become middle income and we go beyond that to become a developed country, that will be a unique story of a country which did it all while being democratic. Right. These are all elements of soft power that can influence the world. And so in a sense, I think we have the opportunity to use our example to exercise influence in the rest of the world. Here is how it can be done in a more humane, a fashion worthy of imitation. Yeah. Flip side, as far as hard power goes, we were always, we were a relatively poor country, and our hard power vis-a-vis the rest of the world was relatively limited, if you talk about it purely in terms of military. And even today, we are actually quite small militarily. We have a lot of people in the armed forces. But if you look at the total spending militarily, we are small relative to the US or even to China. And I think it'll take time for our economy to grow, for us to have a greater sense of hard power. But I think what we should do is combine that soft power, more democratic, more talking about the problems of the world and being a contributor to their solution, rather than muscularly flexing our muscles and saying we are the superpower, just like the other superpowers are doing. We will be no different if we try and flex our muscles just like the United States or China is doing. So in a sense, as we grow richer, we also have to think about what is the best way to grow rich, and how do we influence the rest of the world in a way that is more consistent with our culture? And that, I think, is something we need to think about as we go forward.
Right. One of the things that is most critical to this entire piece, and that you've addressed at length in your book, is about jobs. The social and cultural fabric that you just spoke about. You've mentioned how the lack of adequate employment opportunities has also threatened the social fabric of our country. And if I had to quote the latest State of Working India report by the Azim Premji University, the connection between growth and good jobs continues to be weak. You've specifically mentioned how the manufacturing sector, for instance, has failed to expand its share of GDP or employment significantly. We see a lot of construction and informal services have been main job creators. In such a scenario, if we have to leapfrog from, say, low-skilled manufacturing, which is happening today on the lines of what China did, to a more higher value-added sophisticated manufacturing, how can we do that given our existing challenges of infrastructure, skilling, and R&D?
Well, I think we need to work on all dimensions. And we need to recognize there's no easy solution. Any solution which is solid and sensible will take time. So we need to work on, take, for example, the pandemic kids. We have a lot of kids who went to school during the pandemic, but I mean, actually didn't go to school during the pandemic and have lost a lot of learning in the process. And when you look at the stories that are coming from Jharkhand and Bihar of those kids, it is quite, worrying that these are kids who, you know, never really got a good education even in the past. And now 3 years, they've been two and a half years, they've been out of school. And then they asked to go back in a higher grade. And many of them are dropping out. Some of the attendance levels in some of these classes is very worrisome. How can we even expect to be a strong nation going forward if our kids haven't had even basic education, right? And if many of them aren't capable of doing, any work which requires a little bit of skilling. So in that sense, I think we need to take emergency action, in the first place to make sure all the COVID kids are back on track. A number of states are doing that, but not all states. We need to make sure all states, because the poorer states are the ones that are doing the least in this regard. And we need to do far more. But I would say it's things like this, the basics, that we cannot ignore. Because we say it's going to take a long time. Well, if you have malnutrition kids, they're not going to be capable of anything going forward if they've been significantly malnutritioned, because that stunts their brain, that stunts their body, and they can't really work. So you need to deal with malnutrition on an emergency basis. This is not something that you can say, kabhi kar lenge. It's not going to happen. And so those are the kinds of things we need to work on now. Now, in addition, as we create a stronger workforce, and we're talking all elements, we're talking about skilling, we're talking about building infrastructure, which, there will also be jobs along the way, the construction jobs you're talking about. But if you want higher value-added jobs, you got to start working on the fundamentals right now. And it will take time. But, time passes and you haven't done anything, the problem becomes even bigger. If we haven't tackled human capital, last big effort was during the Vajpayee government. The very big effort on building schools for every kid and making sure everybody went to school. We need big efforts like that going forward to improve human capital. And we're saying, take colleges.
Right.
We talk about being, Vishwa Guru. Which university in India is in the top 100? Not one. By most metrics. I mean, that is a problem. Why is it one of a few of our universities in the top 100? There was an attempt to get universities of eminence, but that's sort of not really done a lot. We need to do this again on a war footing. There's so many things we need to do. And one of the things we keep saying in the book is, one of our biggest failings has been implementation. We need not just have the big ideas, but we need to implement and we need to keep implementing.
Right. In fact, education, I think, is very crucial to this. While India has done well in terms of enrolling kids into primary school education, somewhere down the line, you also mentioned how during the Ukraine war, we saw a lot of the medical school students that are over there, them struggling because India just, why do they need to go there? India just doesn't have enough medical schools, medical institutions to sort of include or educate aspirants. Especially, that's ironical, especially in a country where there is an acute shortage of doctors. So I think these are, like you said, basic level problems that we need to address.
Exactly. I mean, take that particular question. Why don't we have more places for doctors? It's not that we don't have the funds. We just, as Rohit said, invested 17,000 crores in Micron. Can't we invest that in new teaching hospitals, right? It's not that we don't have patients. We have plenty of patients. Right. And it's not that we don't have teachers. I mean, there are plenty of good doctors who can be teachers. Right. So what is missing? In a sense, what is missing is a sense of urgency that we need to do so much more of this. Why are 60, 70,000 of our medical students going abroad when there's such an unmet demand for medical positions? I mean, people pass the NEET, but can't get medical positions because, you know, we don't have enough places for these students. So isn't creating those places not only necessary, but also a job creating process, right? We're creating every new teaching hospital you build is going to create a lot of jobs. So if we thought about this carefully, we'd say, you know, let's be a little more open to other ways of creating jobs than this low-skilled manufacturing that we seem to be embarked on.
And right. I think on this issue, there's also a serious lack of imagination in the sense that, you know, it's not only that it's an input into human capital formation, it is on its own a crucial input in total income of the country. So just this year, 7.5 lakh students from India have gone abroad to study. We have no problems. We went abroad to study. I think it's a great thing. But just in terms of an economic opportunity, by this point, given the level of universities we have had in the past, we should have been teaching people from other countries, right? Do you think of health and education, especially in terms of training people, as an economic opportunity? Or are you just thinking of this something a society needs to do, right? And this is a change in mindset that Raghu is talking about. Literally, we should have been a hub of, by now, of people from developing countries who cannot afford to get a good education in their country, or it's too expensive for them to go to the West, to Western Europe or US, should be coming to India to study medicine, for example. We should have been in that position by now. So not only are we training doctors to help our population, but it's an important economic jobs generator, value addition, all those good things that we're talking about in the book.
Overall, how much do you think India's flourishing startup sector can contribute towards job creation and economic growth?
I think we have to now get out of this space of thinking about startups necessarily as some, you know, three people in a small room trying to think of, you know, there is a sense in which the way the human capital of India is being structured and is moving, both in terms of new firms that are going to, this is what we try to emphasize in the case studies, providing direct services to the world, and firms that are embedding services in manufactured products. The demand for these is only going to rise. So, you know, in terms of direct services, for example, we talk about global capability centers. So the recent NASSCOM report says that they are, you know, have a market size of now $46 billion and employ about 1.7 million people. I think it was JP Morgan who already has 50,000 employees in Bangalore, in the second largest office outside, and I think Goldman Sachs also. So this market is only going to grow because if you need to pay $150,000 to $200,000 to a financial consultant or financial advisor in Goldman Sachs in New York, and the same person you need to pay like $60,000, less than half in Bangalore, this is the reason why these jobs are expanding. So these are direct services. And then firms like Lenskart, firms like the one that we report in the introduction, ID Fresh, which is now providing dosa batter not only in India but also in the Middle East, and I think soon they're expanding even further. These are the innovative ideas that Raghu was talking about, that if you really let ideas like this flourish, you don't even have to restrict them that are they manufacturing, are they services, because a lot of the creative stuff is happening at the intersection. And this, we do think, is just going to really, if it's, you know, if, with enough, you know, reasonable enabling frameworks, if human capital is not a constraint for us, if we are able to produce enough engineers, enough good workers, this type of market is only going to expand because we're only limited by our imagination.
No, I was just going to say, but there's the biggest part which is still eluding us is new products, right? Where is India's TikTok? Where is India's Nvidia? Where is India's Qualcomm, right? These, interestingly, we have people doing chip design in India. By one estimate, 20% of chip design is being done in India. We talked to one of our entrepreneurs that we talked to was actually heading a chip design team for one of the big multinationals from India. So there's a lot of that work being done, but there is no chip design company in India like Nvidia or like Qualcomm. And so there is a real question as to why we can't generate these kinds of companies, why we can't generate a pharmaceutical giant, which doesn't do generic products which somebody else has patented, but patents its own products. Now, people like Biocon are trying, but we need far more of this. And the reality is we don't have the intellectual property producing sort of units that other countries have. And those are called universities. We don't have the high-grade universities producing that kind of intellectual property, which then gets transferred to firms, which then use that as a basis for growth. So think about Google, created in Stanford, actually by these two people under or with the help of an Indian professor who was a topper from IIT Kanpur. Why can't we get those professors back to India, into the universities here, and make those universities the generators of intellectual property along with? So we talked to one of our generic manufacturers, and he said, look, the problem is it's too costly for me to patent drugs. But if the university could do a lot of that, and we're working with U.S. universities, think about how it would be if they worked with Indian universities and they could generate that. So we need to do a lot more in creating the idea-generating factories within the new universities to capture the high ground.
I want to address the, I have a question to ask in terms of products, which Mr. Rajan mentioned. But before that, I also want to talk about small businesses since we are in the topic of job creation. So demonetization and GST killed a lot of small businesses. But one view was that that was a price we had to pay for formalization of the economy. But small scale enterprises are an integral part of, say, more larger, more successful economies. So what can we do to revive and strengthen small scale enterprises in India?
I let Raghu take that. I don't think GST maybe. I don't think demonetization was a price we needed to pay for anything. Okay.
I think we sort of try and find reasons why demonetization was a good thing. I think the evidence is it was uniformly a bad thing. That said, I think the question of whether we need to kill the small enterprises in order to get formalization. That seems like a pretty dramatic and drastic way of doing it. I think any sensible economist would say what you want to do is incentivize the small and medium enterprises to become more formal by giving them some prizes to becoming formal. For example, easier credit. If you become more formal, if you can show that you're paying your taxes, could it be possible to get easier access to credit because you have now formal records showing that you're a tax-paying entity, right? Moreover, we have to, in a sense, reduce the burden of becoming formal. There shouldn't be that, as you become larger, for example, you have all these, significantly increased disclosure requirements and this and that, and higher regulatory penalties. Those are things we should examine. Why is it that people shy away from becoming formal? What is it that we can do to reduce the burden of formality? So rather than, saying with a jhatka, we're going to kill all these small and medium enterprises, instead, let me reduce the burden of formality so that they want to become formal and they can benefit from all the useful things associated with formalization, including the fact that there is much clearer information about them, which allows for easier credit, allows for employees to have more confidence that they'll be around, all those things that are beneficial. So I think we're going about it the wrong way if we say we need to kill them because they're small and informal.
Now coming to the point that you mentioned, why doesn't India have its own TikTok or Qualcomm? When we speak to a lot of these CEOs of these companies, say Girish Mathrubootham of Freshworks or Sridhar Vembu of Zoho, they've of late increasingly made comments about India becoming a stronger product nation. That India is going to be a product nation very soon. What is your response to that? Do you agree that India is becoming a product nation?
No, I think if we do the homework, there's nothing that would prevent us from becoming that. That said, I'm always very wary about us saying we've arrived before we arrive, because that's almost always a recipe for not doing what we need to do. Of course, we need to work on creating those products, and they are there. Some of them, need to be better sort of structured, better marketed. It's not that India lacks for ingenuity, but some of them also require real serious research, and that requires industry and university collaboration in a way that we haven't done as much in the past, but we can do much more in the future. And if industry is willing to fund universities to do that, that's great. I also think, and this is, you know, we should benefit from our diaspora. We have so many really good people in firms around the world. We have a lot of good people in universities around the world. Why don't we attract some of them back and build, you know, new firms, new structures around them? That was how TSMC was built, right? The Taiwan foundry, which makes chips, was built around somebody who came back from the United States, who had been a high official in Texas Instruments, didn't make it to the top, and came back to start TSMC. We have so much knowledge that is embedded in people abroad. Why not use that to leapfrog? We don't have to reinvent everything. We don't have to do it the hard way. We can do it the easier way by attracting them back. And so that seems to be something else we could do to generate that product economy.
Just in terms of the book, like, we point towards many case studies where we do think that we are creating cool products, right? Like the AgniCool case study, the Tejas Network. I think this is something we're very excited about. There's a whole chapter in the book that I recommend your listeners to read called The Creative Economy, where we really emphasize what Raghu is saying about kind of this interface between primary research, fundamental research in universities, and its commercialization by industry. I think this is, and the people you quoted are exactly right, that it is the most exciting space in some sense in Indian industry. Can India really now become a product nation? We're not there yet, but I think a lot more needs to be done, though, in terms of training our human capital and investing much more in fundamental research for us to get there.
Right. So right now, what's stopping, people from being able to achieve that? What's stopping that from happening? Is it the lack of sense of urgency, as you mentioned earlier, or is it something more than that?
Some of it is we haven't maybe had the right breaks. A lot of our products are Me Too products, something that happens elsewhere, some kind of grocery delivery, and it starts up in India. But where is the TikTok of India? Where is the short video? That's now the craze in the US, again, from emerging from China. Can we have more of these Indian products? Some of them may not be particularly require a huge amount of R&D, but may require a lot of thought. I think it'll happen. I think there are lots of young Indians who are now motivated by entrepreneurship, and the ideas will emerge. But I do want to emphasize that, you know, to get a really solid basis behind high-quality ideas, you also need the R&D infrastructure within the country. And we have to spend far more than the 0.6% of GDP that we are spending in order to generate those ideas. And I think that will sort of, beyond the hit and miss, will make it much more likely that we will have good products that we can sell to the rest of the world.
I also want to talk about the dismal participation of women in the labor force. One of the major hurdles in their way is unpaid domestic and caregiving responsibilities, which have increased in the wake of the COVID pandemic. So valuing domestic contributions or helping women get out of their home requires a systemic change, a mindset shift. What are the actions that we as an economy can take that will help?
Well, we talk about a few in that chapter. We have to make it easier to look for work from home. I mean, that's one example of something that can be done. And now we have the technology to do that. So more interviews that can be done online, especially when people have difficulty traveling. But also we need work to be more home friendly. Mm-hmm. We also need, one of the biggest concerns that women have is security, both in getting to the workplace and in the workplace itself. One of the examples that that we cite in the book is how few sort of women are in the hospitality business, especially restaurants and things like that in India. And perhaps that has something to do with the security environment. Contrast that with how many women there are in the airlines, and there perhaps it's a more controlled environment and perhaps a little safer. These are conjectures, but we think that, if we can work on all these dimensions, make it easier for people to do part-time work, for women to do some of their work from home, for women to be able to access jobs again at a distance rather than having to travel to those interviews. If we can ensure greater job security, if we can assure, one of the places where women are doing particularly well is in universities, because universities are a relatively safe place. And there is a fair amount of safety, but also it can be a respectful of the fact that you also have a home and you have concerns about your children. So you can sort of limit your work at the university and be able to work some of it from home. Mm-hmm. That we need to think of more jobs like that. But I think if we can put our imagination to work, but also put public policy to work, there's absolutely no reason why we can't do far better in terms of creating the opportunities for women. And as you said, part of it is also mindset, both on the part of the families, but also on the part of women, to feel that they can actually go out and do those jobs. Now, that is not to say that staying at home is necessarily a bad thing, but it has to be a voluntary thing, right? That they have to decide that that's, in their view, the best thing that they want to do.
Right.
But there's also some very low-hanging fruits, in terms of, we know there is a large amount of data to suggest that women are employed in overwhelming numbers in the textile sector, in the leather apparel sector. And in all these sectors, India had a head start. You don't even need to give large subsidies, but our policy, and we cite certain policies in the book that have led to India falling behind, Bangladesh, Vietnam, and even some European countries, and not being able to take up the space that China is vacating in the textiles business. So if India had a much larger fraction, for example, of the textile business in the world, we would be employing many more women. If, for example, as you rightly suggested, because of certain reasons, women have to stay back home, we don't have a very good model of intergenerational childcare. So as we get urbanized more, there should be a system by which older women are able to do background checks and so on, help much more in child rearing while the younger woman goes out to work, right? This is a model that is practiced all over the world. It's not something we are creating. So these are very low-hanging fruits that with some policy tinkering could actually create many, many more jobs for women. So that's also something, other than security and so on, we should really think about policy choices like these.
Right. For the last part of the interview, I want to talk about the chapters on inequality. There have been views among economists, particularly in the US, and I think the Economic Survey of India 2021-22 also addressed this, a point that a certain level of inequality is good for economic growth, for improving human productivity, social mobility, etc. But what is your view on this? What's your response to this?
No, I think forced equality, where you cut off people who are doing well because they're doing well, I think that's bad. That's sort of one of the downsides of extreme socialism, where you inhibit incentives to do better. So, I think that is not appropriate. At the same time, having very unequal chances at doing well is also bad. You are born in the wrong family at the wrong time in the wrong place, and you have no chance of getting anywhere in life because you haven't had good nutrition, you haven't had good schooling, and you haven't had the right values drilled into you at home. And so you're unable to compete with anybody who's had a very different upbringing. That, to our mind, is also unfair because you have a child who has, due to them, no fault of theirs, essentially ended up with very different life chances from somebody else who had all the right breaks. So we need to remedy the second kind of inequality without basically saying, okay, anybody who does well, we need to cut off their growth, their career, because they're doing too well. We need to bring them down to the level of mediocrity of everybody else. In other words, allow for the opportunities to flourish, but ensure that everybody has has the right starting point. And the starting point is not at birth, but starting point is when the race for the career starts at age 20 or 25, that you've had all the benefits that society can give you in equipping you to run that race well. So you see the difference. The difference is we're not trying to ensure that everybody runs at the same pace in the race. We are ensuring that they all come to the starting point and they have the equal chance to run that race. That, to my mind, is a more just society, which gives everyone that equal chance.
Right. My last question pertains to something that you've mentioned towards the conclusion of your book. You say that one of India's unique strengths is its spirit of inquiry and debate. So how do we protect that? Because when we talk about freedom of speech and expression, it is a fundamental right. But the law says that it is subject to a restriction by law, which says that what you convey cannot go against the interest of the security of the state. In this day and age, can showing bad feelings towards a particular government be construed as undermining the security of the state? And how do we essentially protect the spirit of inquiry and debate?
We say repeatedly in the book that we must not confuse the security of the nation with the security of the government in power. Those are two different things. And all too often, that is the confusion that seems to pervade the public sphere, including many government officials who basically say, you're criticizing us, you're criticizing the state, you're criticizing the nation. No, you're not criticizing the nation. You're criticizing your incompetence as a government. That should be fair game. That is a fair game in democracy, that you should be able to criticize the government as much as you want. But you should not be focused on breaking up the country. That's a different thing. And all too often, you know, we use sedition laws against, young students who are just protesting the policies of the government in power. And they should be allowed to protest all they want. After all, that is the purpose of democracy, to, you know, in part allow that pressure to get diffused, but in part also to hear them because they have something important to say. The same people who, you know, today are in power were protesting the emergency, a number of years back. Were they wrong or were they right? I used to have a discussion with Mr. Jaitley, who was finance minister when I was RBI governor, and he used to talk about those emergency days and how, you know, they were in jail. Was Mr. Jaitley an anti-national? Absolutely not. He was not. He was fighting for freedom of speech and expression at that time. And Mr. Advani made a very important statement about the press, which we cite in the book. When you were asked to bow, you crawled, or I don't remember.
You were asked to bend, but you crawled.
When you were asked to bend, you crawled.
You crawled. Yeah.
I mean, when the people in the ruling party admit that they were the protesters one point in time, they should acknowledge that there are others who are the protesters at this point in time who have very different views from the ruling party. But I mean, both sides care for the nation. We can't just point a finger at protesters and say they're anti-national. But I think this is more general, that an authoritarian country will never create the ideas that are needed for longer-term success. It will suppress those ideas because ideas hit at the establishment, whether they are political ideas, whether they're scientific ideas. And that is why the Soviet Union never became an extraordinary innovator. Yeah, it did some good stuff in defense. But, you know, consumer innovation, forget the thought. And I would argue that people in China are saying the same thing now, that China is becoming more authoritarian. That, in fact, China's best days in terms of innovation, at least on the consumer level, may be behind them. And I don't think India should go that way. So let us not take these authoritarian countries as a model and recognize there are deep, deep problems with authoritarianism, which is why we shouldn't lose our democracy by any stretch of imagination.
Right. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Rajan. Rohit, was wonderful speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good luck.
So, folks, that was Raghuram Rajan, former Reserve Bank of India governor, and Rohit Lamba, an economist at Pennsylvania State University. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I'm Divya Shekhar. See you next time.